Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Welcome everybody to the final keynote for Saturday. Not the final sessions, there are more things after this, but this is the final keynote in our room on From Trump's Wall to Policing Culture, Understanding Borders Today. Obviously borders in their sort of physical form are rarely out of the news, whether it's the migrant crisis and immigration that's spurred on by the troubles in North Africa, or whether it's Trump getting in the news about proposed border with Mexico. But really the role of walls and borders and boundaries is a deeper and wider phenomenon. Those of you who've been in this room throughout the day when we had sessions on who are the people and who are the establishment may have noted that throughout those sessions, one of the things that was emerging was lots of people beginning to characterise a sort of a clash between those for whom a world of fluidity and boundlessness and being able to move countries is very successful and they can take advantage of that, and those for whom the benefits or the security or the certainty provided by borders and reliable understandings of how things will work is something that's needed or wanted. So whilst obviously there's this element of physical borders, which we will touch on in the discussion, the concept of borders and boundaries is much wider. To touch on just a couple, you can think of the boundaries between identity. Who am I? Am I a fixed thing? Am I something that's evolving? Am I something that's up for discussion? Or am I something, as I say, that's fixed and I have a clear sense of who I am? There are also political borders, such as particularly relevant at the moment, between those of being a citizen and not being a citizen. There's been discussions on whether EU nationals or non-UK citizens should have the right to vote in UK elections, and that, in part, that discussion turns on an understanding of whether you think there's a special boundary between being a national citizen or whether there is no special boundary. And then there are also conceptual or philosophical borders and boundaries, such as that between the private sphere, which people like to think of as the safety of your home and of your private family and friends, and the public sphere, where we are today having this discussion. So the concept of borders and boundaries is much wider than simply physical walls. There's obviously in there an awful lot to unpack, and I'm very, very glad to welcome a really excellent panel to help us pick this out. I'll introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. They'll speak for sort of 5 to 7 minutes. As ever, at the Battle of Ideas, I'll try and be as rigorous as I can with the timekeeping to make sure there's plenty of time for discussion with the audience. So speaking first on my immediate left is Professor Frank Faraday. He's a sociologist and social commentator, author of numerous books, including How Fear Works, The Culture of Fear in the 21st Century, and Populism and the European Culture Wars. Frank is a big friend and contributor to the festival. You hopefully will see him around a little bit more at the festival, but he's always one of the leading lights for us at the Academy of Ideas, and we're very glad to have him on this panel. We welcome Frank. Then on my far left is Rebecca Lowe, who's a researcher, freelance writer and consultant doing, as I just overheard, her part-time PhD in property theory. She's the former director of FRIA and also the author of Why Democracy Taking Political Rights Seriously. Rebecca, likewise, has been contributing to the battle at least for a couple of years now, always very philosophical and reflective. So we're very glad to have Rebecca. And then on my far right is Dr. Zoe Strimple. She's a historian at the University of Sussex. You might see her columns in the Sunday Telegraph. She's also the author of Seeking Love in Modern Britain, Gender, Dating, and the Rise of the Single, and also the author of what's almost a complete manuscript, though I'm sure we'll be finding a publisher very soon, called Loveless Island, The End of Sex. Can we welcome Zoe? Then it's Sabina sitting on my immediate right, who poses the biggest problem in introducing her, because her biography features lots of German words, which I won't try to do justice to. But she's the chair of the Freiburg Institute in Berlin. She's the CEO of a company which I just daren't pronounce because I'll get it so badly wrong, and the author of a book which I'll give you the translated title to save myself the trouble, Brexit and the Struggle for Democracy in Great Britain, but that is in German. Sabina has been involved in the Battle of Ideas for a while now. She also helps us with the satellite event that we do in Berlin every year, so if you find yourself in Berlin soon, you can find details of that in your brochure. We're really, really grateful to have Sabina on this discussion. Can we welcome her? In my haste to introduce our great panel, I should have told you who I am. I'm Jacob Reynolds. I'm the partnerships manager here at the Academy of Ideas, helping put together this festival. Really glad to be chairing this discussion. I've been thinking through lots of the keynotes, if you've seen any today. So far, so good. So hopefully we can keep this going. But for now, enough from me, and I'll hand over to Frank for his introduction.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I finished writing a book on this subject on Friday, so I'm still totally obsessed with the question. And the reason why I managed to or thought about writing a book on borders was because I noticed that suddenly everybody is for open borders. You know, everybody within culture is talking about how bad borders are. And so what I did was I Googled open borders, and I saw there was Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and you have Clans Without Borders and Sex Workers Without Borders. And you have, I mean, basically anything that moves is without borders. It's on Google. And when you sort of talk to people, you realize that, you know, borders have got a very bad reputation. Now, I became interested in this because as somebody that has thought about it, I realized that borders are a very difficult question, because any border immediately brings into focus a fundamental human contradiction between the aspiration for security. You know, we all want a bit of security, want to close our doors and have a border around us, but we also have an aspiration for freedom, the desire to move beyond where we are and to explore and to experiment. And I think that's what that's what my book is really all about. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that the open borders movement, or the reaction against borders, is not driven by what you think it's driven by this desire to be genuinely free, to take risks and to explore. It is really driven by this kind of corrosive sort of sensibility of refusing to take responsibility for the drawing of lines. Now, why do I say that? The reason why I say that is because when you look around the world today, you'll find that a number of themes are running in parallel, and they're also mutually reinforcing. So people are saying that the borders between nation states are evil, they're sites of violence, there's nothing to recommend it, you should get rid of them. Then you look at the border between the private sphere and the public sphere, and people are saying this is really bad, privacy we shouldn't trust, there is all these dark abuse going on behind closed doors, we need transparency. I mean, transparency is something that everybody loves. So therefore, what we need to do is to, in a sense, make sure that the private sphere, the home, is more open to public scrutiny than is the case in the past. That somehow privacy is really, really being uptight. It's bad for your psychology. We need to open up and let our inner secrets become public property. You look at the border that distinguishes men and women. I mean, call me old-fashioned, but, you know, I used to think that there was only two biological sexes. You know, I thought, yeah, people with two X chromosomes, and then people with XY chromosomes, and that was it. Then you discover that actually there are more than, you know, not just men and women, but a lot of other biological sexes that I've never encountered, and the whole boundary between men and women is now put to question. Then you look a step further, and I come across a series of articles being written about the fact that we're so anthropocentric that we don't realize that the border between human beings and animals is artificial. Of course, it is, every border is artificial. Although, you know, I mean, it wasn't God that said, let there be a border. It just, you know, human beings create borders, but that's part of being a human. So we should somehow rethink the border between humans and animals. You go a step further, something I feel particularly strongly about. What's happened to the border between adults and children? Now, call me again old-fashioned, but there used to be a time when it was very, you know, very, very clear that these were the adults, right? They're the ones that give directions to these little things. And there was a kind of qualitative difference between the two. It wasn't like we have today, where we basically say that children and adults were, you know, that's a very artificial division, right? It is a really artificial division. Therefore, we should rethink the borders that we have between the two. And in fact, there's this weirdness now going on that adults can learn a lot from children, right? So basically, you know, you get these demonstrations where you have 12-year-old children with posters saying, you adults have ruined the world. We're going to teach you, you know, what the world should look like. Well, good luck with that, you know, sort of. So that border is then called into question. And I can give you loads, in my book I give about, you know, loads of examples, you know, health and illness, normalcy and abnormalcy, all those things are called into question. But the one that I feel particularly strongly about as an intellectual is the calling into question of what's called binaries, the fact that we think in binary terms, that basically we make distinctions like good and bad, right? That we make a distinction between sort of kind of concepts, because what's happened now is that increasingly the act of making distinctions, moral distinctions and intellectual distinctions, is seen as artificial, and not just artificial but divisive. And if you go to a university and you mention the word binary, people will smirk, ho, 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 ho. So such inflexible thinking, binary thinking. Well, of course, you cannot think in this world of ours without in binary terms, unless you're a complete idiot. You know, you're not going to, you know, fail to make distinctions between right and wrong. I mean, that's something that we do, and we've done in mathematics and all the rest of that. So the question I ask myself, you know, why is this happening? Why are all the borders called into question? And I come to the conclusion that what's happening in our society is that we've privileged two values. In a world where values are not taken very seriously, we basically decided that in the Anglo-American world particularly, but also in Western Europe, the foundational value of our society is non-judgmentalism. That not judging is seen as a good thing. Non-judgmentalism means that you're a sensitive person, you're flexible, you don't judge, you know, and therefore we need to create a culture that doesn't really judge anymore. And teachers are told not to judge your children too much. You know, sort of in culture we're told that judging is a really, really bad thing, all the while realizing that judgment is the only medium through which we communicate as human beings. In the very act of talking to you, unless I'm a complete airhead, I'm judging you. I'm making, you know, distinctions in my mind, and judging is actually a creative way of communicating. I mean, without judgment, there is no communication. There is simply a series of dialogues. The second value that's linked to non-judgmentalism is now we're now valuing the value of openness. Now, I don't know when openness became a value. I mean, it took a bit of a stretch. But we now think that being open, you know, and openness itself is inherently a good thing. Now, by openness, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're open-minded or you're kind of open to new experiences. Openness simply means transparency. And increasingly, openness is used as not what it used to be in the old days. In the old days, openness was the opposite to secrecy. Openness is now used as the antidote to privacy, that privacy is somehow a negative kind of phenomenon. And openness basically means that you're so open, right, that anything that stands in its way, any line that is drawn, is seen as being absolutely a negative phenomenon. And in intellectual life, we got this word that we're using all the time to give openness a cultural sort of foundation, which is the importance of transgression, right? That we need to be transgressive as a way of being intellectual, at least sensitive individuals. Now, again, there's nothing really wrong with transgression. But when transgression becomes a default orientation towards the world, it ceases to be transgression. Because when transgression, everybody's transgressing, then there is no cost to it. I mean, the thing about transgression historically, if you transgress, you pay the price. Now you don't. And I just want to end by one last sentence making the point that even if you disagree with me, the one thing you have to understand that in order to rebel and to kick up, you need borders to kick up against. If you haven't even got borders to react against, you know, what you're left with is this existential emptiness, which I think is what this anti-border moment represents in the 21st century.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks a lot for that. Next up, over to Rebecca.
Thanks so much, Jacob, and thanks very much, everybody, for being here. So the question I would like to address is, are any borders worth defending? This is one I was particularly drawn to that I took from the rubric describing the event. I'm hoping it might help me to try to get somewhere near to the heart of the matter. So first, I think to me it seems obvious that border is a pretty expansive concept. Yes, I think it's fair to say it's a clear concept. It's definitely widely understood. But man, it's wide, isn't it? I mean, in some sense, the word border could be seen to describe pretty much any delineation, an edge of anything with any kind of edges. And that's most things. It means that there's a border or borders between me and you and everyone else, between pieces of paper placed side by side or on top of each other, between concepts, between ideas. It would seem really that anything that is distinct, whether physical or not, is going to have some kind of borders and probably go some way to forming various other borders too, and maybe that anything that doesn't have borders isn't distinct. So straight off, therefore, it's going to be hard, I think, to pass any kind of judgment on borders in the sense of trying to decide whether they could be the kind of thing that I should be defending. I think it's also important to recognise that these things, borders, are often, they're just here and here to stay, whether we defend them or not. Yes, many borders are created, but many are simply an essential descriptive fact of life, whether we want them to be or not. In some cases, then, if you don't like a border, it might be more that you need to find a way around it than trying to pull it down or deny its existence. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is that there are some real-world conceptual and or physical feasibility considerations that we need to take into account when thinking about most, if not all, borders, even when doing so normatively. And this is on top of the way in which these border things are, well, all over the place. All that said, the first classic example of a border that I'd like to consider is probably the most obvious, the national border. Now, getting rid of this kind of border, failing to defend them, might sound superficially like a really nice idea. And as Frank pointed out, there are a lot of people out there, quite serious people, making these arguments, and some people find them very persuasive. I mean, it'll appeal on some level to anyone with an interest in equality or an interest in recognising the role that luck plays in happiness and success, the luck of the draw regarding where you're born, perhaps, particularly, and to anyone with an interest in freedom, as well as many other things. Now, of course, however, when you start to think about national borders even just a little further, you realise you also need to take into account some complex, potentially counter issues too. Cultural and societal norms, scarcity and allocation, security, and so many other things. And quickly, they're not half as obviously such a nice idea. Now, I realise that's an incredibly cursory look at one of the most important and emotive topics of our day, and I'd hate you to think I'm being flippant or facetious, but rather, I just really wanted to repeat my point about feasibility, about reality and the laws of physics, rather than utopian impossibilities that ignore both the world in which we live and the kinds of creatures we are. But also, secondly, to signal the important role that competing interests play here, a point I'll come back to later. Before that, though, I'd like to try to go as simple as possible. So the two most definite examples of borders that I can think of are, and I say this realising that there's at least one mathematician in the room, so please come and shout at me afterwards if I'm wrong on this, but one of these examples is the border between two contiguous identically sized squares. The second, I'm a little more sure about, so it doesn't bring my maths into question, is the border between true and false. You can't have more truthful or less truthful. There is a single clear, all-powerful line there, as there is, I believe, between the two squares. Sure, it's a matter of truth that the UK is surrounded by the sea and that various European countries are divided in part by mountains, but those lines are messy, and the issue of national borders doesn't just depend on those kinds of truths. Now, truth plays an important part, I'd conjecture, in all border questions. Indeed, I'd argue that it plays an important part in questions of all kinds, And my view is that many difficult current issues have been made purposefully and unnecessarily complicated by a lack of commitment to the concept of truth. Some people, postmodernists for instance, want to deny that there is such a thing as truth. And some people, let's call them, for instance, the Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker crew, want to persuade us that there is truth, but the only route to it is via the scientific method. Now, I love science too, as much as the next person. In fact, more so, I'm pretty obsessed with rockets and space and all that kind of science particularly. But those guys' approach ignores other important routes to truth, arguments about values, for instance, which can help to lead us to search out truths about politics or morality. And this brings us to my second classic example of borders, the border, which Frank has already mentioned, between men and women. Yes, the border, the division, the line, the idea that there are these two different delineated sets, men and women. Now, again, I'm afraid I don't have time to address this in full, also highly important and emotive topic, but I do believe that there is a biological difference, a border, if you like, between the set women and the set men. To me, this is an example of that kind of truth that is indeed determinable through the scientific method. And that me publicly admitting this here is highly controversial, go ahead, shout at me on Twitter, shows again the salience of this topic of borders and particularly its necessary relation to truth. But basically, I think what I'm saying so far is that when considering the topic of borders and their aptness for a defence, there will be some various conceptual feasibility-type questions, some science-type questions, some moral and political questions, and so on. My final classic example of borders is the border between home and the wider world. And this brings us, I think even more so than when thinking about national borders, to the obvious reason we might defend a non-natural, human-created, anthropogenic, maybe, border, and that's security. It's a sad fact of life that human beings are pretty vulnerable, that we face dangers, not just from bad people, but also from natural forces. Without the border of a dwelling place, we face the weather, the wolves, and so on. Now, of course, there are many further reasons to value a home, but most people would see some sort of defined shelter as one of the most very basic of human needs. That's not to say its border must keep everyone else out, of course, but it does lead to some questions about whom should be let in. Now, in terms of like a small shelter, a tent maybe, it seems obvious and reasonable that the main dwellers of that shelter should get to determine whom should be let in and not. But as soon as we start to move beyond the small shelter, or even in the case of those small shelters, if resources are particularly scarce, or the outdoors is particularly dangerous, lots of those wolves, we reach the complex world of competing interests once more. Why should the owners of the big house keep out the poor? Or the nation with the vast natural resources? We return quickly to a wide range of questions and truths, even with this most obvious of examples, same as before, some relating to feasibility or truth, and some relating to preferences for certain approaches, approaches to community, to wealth creation, to principles and guiding goals. But much of this, I think, relates to the domain of the domain, what it is that we seek to determine the scope or extent of, that edges around the borders of, the bordered thing itself, and how it is we seek to determine the decision makers of these matters, the people or truths that are most relevant, public, private, individual, familial, local, regional, national, international. And sometimes we get these fundamental things wrong. So to finish, to think about a border, we have to think about what it's bordering, whom or what it shows differentiation from or exclusion to and why. And that's just the starting point for beginning, for being able to begin to decide whether it's a thing worth defending. Yet too often these days, it seems as if we can't even get there.
Great, wonderful. Thanks so much, Rebecca. I'm going to hand over now to Zoe for her opening remarks.
Okay. Let's talk about sex, babies. Except that line has now lost some of its potency because we've sort of slightly been talking about sex, but I want to talk about a different kind of sex. So I'm going to use this sort of few minutes to discuss borderlessness and borders in sexual culture. So I want to suggest that in being dramatically opened up through a share-all, celebrate-all approach, the erotic realm has actually become more rule-bound than ever, with different, but certainly not fewer, boundaries and borders to negotiate. The result is that getting laid has never been so complicated. Let me elaborate with a few points from this book. I'm sort of in the early stages of writing, which Jacob mentioned, is cheerily called Loveless Island, The End of Sex. So vast strides have indeed been made in recent decades towards the liberalization of sex, including the embrace of all sorts of sexual practices and identities, and the fostering of newly bold and self-knowing languages of pleasure. This was supposed to make sex and its close relations of romance, the erotic, and so on, freer and therefore better. Pitting ourselves against the agonies of shame and the cruelties of shaming is a perfectly laudable thing to do for sex. Let me be clear. But in pursuing openness and inclusivity so furiously, we have banished subtext, grey areas, and the non-PC realities of certain gut reactions. And ironically, in doing so, we have unleashed a tsunami of new rules and taxonomies, more borders, in other words, between the legit and the frowned upon, the good citizen response and the sexist, regressive one. Anyone who has been on a dating app recently or listened to an American sex podcast will know that the erotic today has become an exhausting parade of skills and wants, requiring ever greater willingness to break new ground, try new things, push new boundaries, or else be seen as a prude or, worst of all, vanilla. More and more people are open and specific about an ever-growing shopping list of turn-ons and identities. Witness the rise on the likes of Bumble and Tinder of people identifying as ethically non-monogamous, ethically polyamorous, monogamish, gray ace, which is somewhere between asexual and sexual, aromantic, not desirous of a romantic relationship, pansexual, attracted to all genders, sexualities, and sexual identities, sapiosexual, turned on by intelligence, heteroflexible, mostly or sometimes heterosexual, and autosexual, turned on by oneself, and that's just a small selection. The taxonomies continue. As well as having to process the sexual preferences of potential matches at the outset, right under their photo, the user of Tinder and Bumble or Hinge et al. Now is tersely informed where the person they're looking at sits in the menu of Myers-Briggs personality types. Knowing if a prospective date is an ISTJ, the inspector, or ESFJ, the provider, is presumably helpful for assessing compatibility. But any sense of discovery, affection, or even kindness is gone in this clearing house of kink, a hostile land of a million new borders. Many profiles read like lectures or already furious harangues, outlining their owners' views on kink, intimacy, and relationships, what they want and what they don't. No drama, no time wasters, no bad dancers, reads the profile of Joe, 26, an entrepreneur. Kinky, dirty, you have to be too. Swipe only if open-minded. One feels like crawling under a rock. There's too much to get right and wrong. A telling off feels like it's never far away in this inclusive paradise. Then there's gender. If on one level gender differences are being eroded, then on another, they are greater and more grating than ever in the brinkmanship and tired banter passing between men and women seeking each other for sexual concord. Here, another paradox asserts itself. The gulf between men and women has never been smaller by technical, legislative, cultural, professional, and social measures. Yet as they encounter each other in the chambers of Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, and OkCupid, the border fence between them has grown high. Everyone is cross and fed up with everyone else for being so rubbish that they have to keep swiping. Conversations begin but don't continue or take shape. The sheer awfulness of grammar is exposed. Nobody can be bothered to meet up. Men come in droves, women in oceans. So who can care about either? Men serious about meeting someone can't contain their annoyance at the slow replies and signs of disinterest that dog their dating app lives. The growing prominence of the incel, involuntary celibate, community has drawn attention to the most extreme and sickening type of male sexual frustration. Meanwhile, those able to cash in on the sexual options the atmosphere seems to promise, good-looking, tall men with decent jobs, let the women they converse with know that they're interested chiefly in playing with them at their convenience, and I'm sure their female equivalents do the same, or a version of it. So attempts to flatten out sexual difference and deconstruct the idea of exclusivity have radically reshaped the intimate landscape. But this new sexual scaffolding, in which limits, binaries, and margins are seen as bad, and in which being a pansexual, ethically polyamorous, submissive cuckold is seen as something to lead with, has only introduced more checkpoints. In seeking to do away with categories, which are seen as restrictive and oppressive, we have only bred a new raft of them. Thank you.
Great, thanks for that, Rebecca. Thanks so much. Hand over to Sabina.
Well, as a German, I don't want to talk about sex, really. I want to talk about about national borders, which is much closer to our... I was going to pick up on two questions which I came across in the debate about borders in these last weeks and months, which I think draw out the problem of the open borders debate a bit. And the first is linked to the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which we're going to celebrate just next week. And the way this event has now been appropriated by many of the open border faction. I've got an example of this is a newspaper article which just recently appeared in the German weekly Die Zeit. Professor Jan Zielonka, who is professor for European politics in Oxford, wrote, "Three decades ago, we celebrated the fall of the Berlin Wall. This was the mother of all walls. Unfortunately, today, walls are back in vogue around the world. An ever larger part of the electorate supports politicians calling for the restoration of sovereign nation states." Now, to me, I think that is a distortion of history. Because if we look at the liberation movements of the 1980s, none of them wanted to abolish borders, nor did they actually want to abolish the nation, the sovereign nation state. Quite to the contrary, these were movements in order to re-establish the sovereign nation state against Stalinist domination. We see this very clearly when we look at the Polish liberation movement, which kicked the whole thing off in 1980, the Solidarność movement in Gdansk, where people came out, the workers came out, came out on strike. And if you look at the photos, you see the Polish flag everywhere. Even the slogan of the Solidarność movement alluded to the Polish flag, red on white black background. And of course, in Germany, it was very, very similar. The call for reunification became a crucial and central call very, very quickly. Germans in the East demanding the rights which had been withheld them for so long, for 40 decades, as Germans, not because they were nationalists, but because they realized how important it was to fight for not just better living standards, but also for democracy and freedom. And all of this was very much linked, I believe, to borders. And of course, the question is, why would somebody like Mr. Zielonka, like Professor Zielonka, make that point? Well, he's actually not talking about the 1980s or 1989 liberation. What he's really talking about is the EU, which was established 2 years later through the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. And his piece is very much a defense of the EU. And that sort of got me thinking that the whole open borders debate is very often a cover for other interests, for other sort of political, for a completely different political agenda. The second example which I have, I think, is a bit more complicated and also shows the dilemma we're confronted with, and that relates to the German captain Carola Rakete. Was also very prominent in the German press, who steered her ship Sea-Watch 3 into the Italian harbour after she'd rescued migrants. Now, to be fair, and I think that does touch on some of the problems we have with the discussion of open borders, I did realize that Carola Rakete was reacting to the very hollow promise of the EU of open borders, because what we know is that even in the post-Cold War era, borders never disappeared, and even the EU never got rid of borders, because what happened was that borders were pushed to the periphery of Europe or even outside of Europe, became very militarized, their power actually potentiated by taking them away from democratic control. So I do see that there was this issue. There is a very real humanitarian problem, and criticizing the rescue of migrants in the Mediterranean, I think, is very difficult and certainly not in my interest. However, very quickly, this action too had a rather authoritarian turn to it. So the evening before she actually went into the Italian harbour violating Italian sovereign rights, she gave an interview in which she said, if Italy doesn't cooperate, we can only force the solution. Now, again, as a German, that kind of got me very nervous because it does sound like an invasion. And I realised that when we're talking about borders, borders do define areas in which laws and rights are respected and people feel safe and secure. And to just say we're going to force the solution, we're going to go against the laws and the rights of another country, does seem very, very problematic to me, even though I do understand that she was in quite a desperate situation. The other problem, of course, is that the message she brought across was then became very much a message of migrants against Italians. She didn't very much care what the majority of the Italian people actually thought, nor of the democratically elected, nor did she take any consideration of the democratically elected government. I think my kind of apprehensions of this whole action were then confirmed when the same person, Carola Rackete, then went off. She sort of offloaded her charge, the migrants in Italy, then went off and became an international activist and became the main face of Extinction Rebellion in Germany, talking about how she had been organizing protests in different European countries. So a person who's very much floating above the nation state, not really saying she's taking responsibility for the world, but not really taking responsibility for any real situation. So leaving Italians in Italy with the problem of how to deal with the situation and then sort of moving off, I think is a denial of responsibility. I think I came to the conclusion that the argument to, you know, the open borders, I've always argued in favor of keeping borders as open as possible. But I do think often there is this turn to, you know, no borders, and I think that's become a very counterproductive call. And I think if we want to support or want to find a solution to the migration crisis, I think we have to definitely fight this idea of abolishing all borders.
Thank you. So before going out to the audience, I just want to pose or clarify the couple of questions that came from maybe my right side of the table to the left side of the table in the form of the question of what both picked up on in terms of whether it's the borderlessness within the EU creating hard borders around the edges of the EU or the abolition of cultural borders and boundaries and sexuality creating somehow all this greater number of borders and boundaries. And pose the question, why? What do you guys think underlies this fact that if you begin to abolish certain kinds of borders, new ones proliferate? And just some quick thoughts on that and then we'll go out to the floor.
I'll come in first and then. Well, I call this in my book The Paradox of Borders. And what the paradox of borders means is that in the very act of calling for abolishing some borders, you then embrace and create another kind of border. So in America, you have all these people who are denouncing Trump and his message of build the wall as being, you know, this is horrible. How can you possibly say something like that? You know, we don't want any walls. We don't want any borders. And the same people who are 120% against building the wall are also 120% for building safe spaces around their existence and quarantining themselves from criticism. And you'll find, I think it's very interesting, if you follow through, for example, Zoe's examples, one of the most interesting things about sexuality is that since the beginning of this kind of puritanical turn towards essentially policing sex, because that's what's really going on, what you now have is the introduction of micromanagement of spontaneous informal relations to the point at which undergraduates coming to university have got to go to consent workshops. So the very idea that we cannot just consent, you know, sort of spontaneously, we got to have some kind of regulation that manages that, which would have been unthinkable, you know, even a couple of years ago, has now been institutionalized. And when you think about the strict codes that have been introduced, when you look at the way that culture is being policed, I mean, the whole policing of cultural appropriation, I mean, everything to do with culture is not policed, and there are all these borders being drawn. Then you realize that what has happened is that by calling into question the national border element, the kind of borders that organically developed historically, which created the space within which communities could be communities, by eroding their moral authority, what you've done is you privatized bordering. And if you don't believe me, go on Google and you'll find there are hundreds and hundreds of self-help books that tell people how to protect their personal space, that tell people how to draw boundaries. I mean, this in America, it's a big thing. How do I draw boundaries? But it's around myself, the individual. So it's become privatized, individualized, fragmented, and utterly petty.
Rebecca.
Yeah, so I think two thoughts come to mind about why these sort of this paradox or these new divisions might be arising. One is, I think, relates to something I was saying earlier about truth, and I think this sort of loss of adherence, or at least loss of sort of desire to fight for the idea of objectivity, particularly in the moral realm. So the idea that there are answers, and instead there's this idea, oh, it's nicer to be fluid, to be subjective. And I think this has led to a kind of person who I find really quite difficult to engage with. It's the people who think that there's no such thing as right and wrong, but also they know that they are right. And these people are very difficult to engage with. And it also leads, unfortunately, to a situation in which you can't really get to answers or even agreement or even really have a discussion, because usually you would have done that in terms of, like, your point about judgment, about making judgments about their claims, potentially doing this in quite a logical way or even just a, you know, just a reasonable way. So this leads to a loss of civility. It also leads to a loss of the idea that there potentially are answers out there. And this, I don't want to sound like Noam Chomsky or something, but it basically means that then it's all down to power. So who's going to be able to bash the other person over, rather than the idea that we're all equal and we all have reasonable, we have reason and we're capable of engaging and coming to some correct answer about this. The second point, just very briefly, relates to my point about feasibility and in the sense of the kinds of creatures we are. We have rights and we also have responsibilities. And I think traditionally we were quite cognizant of the fact that we might have some special obligations to those people around us, particularly if you're a parent maybe to your child. That doesn't mean you don't have obligations to other children, but you might have some special obligations to your child over that child. Now, we can argue all day about those things, whether those things are right or wrong, but they've certainly been just seem natural to human beings, I think, basically through the entirety of human existence. But lately, now, in a fantastic way, we have better communication, we're more aware of all of the people in the world. We seem closer to those people too. And I think it's quite hard to reconcile that. If you can see online, you can speak to somebody in a country where they're, it's a war-torn nation, and you can see your kid with all of the privileges and benefits of living in a country like ours, all of a sudden, those special obligations seem harder to defend. I do defend them myself, but I can understand why some people don't.
Okay, great. Some quick thoughts that got us started, but very much over to the audience now. So I know we've got people with mics on both sides of the room. So that mic can start. Did I just see a hand at the back there? If not, it can come down to this gentleman sitting there. That microphone there, with the light slightly struggling, but I'm just going to go with who I can see at the front here. So otherwise, put your hands up nice and high, because otherwise I won't necessarily be able to see them.
Hey, I'm wondering.
Sorry, there are two things that I need to ask you to stand up because of the camera. Sorry, I should mention that.
Can't we respond to what you said, or is that going to happen next?
I'll take you in first.
I was only wondering, in the same way that, for example, around 100 years ago, anarchism and communism were trying to pull the rug out from everyone else to make us reassess what we wanted to pay for, how we wanted to do it, and really shook democracies and other regimes across the world into acting in whatever way. Are these people who are trying to tear apart all boundaries, these no boundaries people, actually giving us an opportunity to reassess what boundaries we do value, and therefore the ones that stand after this could be a short crisis, could be a long crisis, are actually the ones that deserve to stay standing? Is this as an important test that we need to take?
Great, thanks. So there's this gentleman here. The next hand I saw is here, and then we're going to go over to that person there. But first, why don't you just take that back, and then we'll pass this one along. So this gentleman here.
Okay, yeah, just going to the points you're all making about the end of sex. I'm just glad I'm not 30 years younger and in this minefield.
And
is it a natural sort of means of depopulation? is that what's happening? Because I feel sorry for my kids, I really do. But going back to the border thing, the national borders, and we say, well, let's have open borders. Yeah, let's have open borders, but provided there's a level playing field. And at the moment, there isn't a level playing field. I mean, we take the example of European. Two of arguably the most corrupt countries on the planet, South Africa and Mexico, have a free trade agreement with the European Union. Why? Would some please explain to me? I think I know the reason why, but I'd like you to have a view on it.
OK, great. So there's someone with the mic. This microphone can be passed along, and we'll hear this person's thoughts.
Borders seem to provide a purpose and an identity between concepts, and they can be quite functional, not just kind of categorizations and stuff. And so the question seems to me to be, which borders are legitimate, and what principles can we use to help define which borders and categorizations should be legitimate and which ones should be discarded?
Great, thanks. So we'll take this gentleman down here.
Several of the panel have mentioned a place of self and of home. Is it perhaps conceivable that the catastrophic collapse of intellectual and cultural self-confidence in the West over the past 30 years, really since the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the end of the fight against communism, is at the heart of this struggle we have to assert borders? We no longer feel ourselves competent or capable or even able in a general sense to establish borders because we no longer feel confident in ourselves to say, this is who I am, this is my set of values, this is my oikos, as Roger Scruton has so often written. And therefore, we look at the world and we no longer consider ourselves capable of making judgments about quality or indeed about values, and that leads essentially to an inertia.
Great. And anyone, just so given that you're right there with the microphone, fantastic. You can tell that. Then we'll hear from a couple of our panel and we'll come back out.
It's on the question of national borders, because I think from some of the people involved in the discussion, not on the panel but sort more broadly, there appears to me to be what appears to be dishonesty in the discussion about what borders are acceptable and what borders aren't. And I just wonder if people might explain a bit more to me what might be going on. I saw an interesting discussion recently. It was a video discussion on Greece versus Rome. And Mary Beard from Cambridge was for Rome, and the heavyweight intellectual Boris Johnson was for Greece. The discussion around citizenship and borders came up, and Mary Beard pressed the point and won the audience round quite strongly on the basis that Rome, unlike Greece, that was for closed society of Greece, Rome was an open society, and the most important issue was security, and what people valued more than democracy was security. And I thought it was quite an interesting discussion because really both of them were playing out a discussion pre-referendum about Europe. And I thought the fact that Mary Beard won the audience round around the issue of security was interesting because you thought she's not really talking about no borders, she's talking about a European border. And there's a contradiction there, isn't there? Because when I encounter Brexiteers that I know who want to leave Europe, one of the things they most passionately feel about is defending a border within Britain, which feels quite alien to me. So I think there's some contradictions going on. But also, I think, from the likes of people like Mary Beard, some dishonesty about what they mean, because they are in favour of borders.
Great, thanks. So I'll take the two on my right, just first, Zoe and Sabina. Just any thoughts from the audience? Also, if you want to come back on this discussion that was happening. But
No, because I realise a lot of you are here with an eye on the geopolitical state of affairs, and I'm trying to do something about borders in a more intimate sphere, a subjective sphere, but I think that some of the things overlap. So just thinking, first thing to say, yes, so, you know, we need sort of categories and borders with which to simply think. And when we do away with it in the name of all the things Frank mentioned, you know, to seem transparent, to seem, you know, open and you know, all that sort of stuff, we end up in a massive amount of confusion, which I think is evident in, you know, I think this is the bridge to these wider questions and the debates about Brexit and with identity politics, the fact that it doesn't really make sense, it's constantly collapsing. On one hand, everyone is supposed to be able to be everything, you shouldn't define people or pigeonhole people. On the other hand, people's entire identities are bound up in the most restrictive categories of, for instance, skin color. So, but I think that when it comes to, you know, just responding to Jake saying about sort of the logics, or what Frank was saying about the logics of this happening in sex, I think it's worth, you know, thinking about these things in tandem slightly. Sexual rule-boundedness and constraints has a long theoretical history, and indeed a long history. And the idea, just to rebut slightly what Frank was saying, that this is a new thing, that suddenly we're obsessed with policing sex, the bureaucratization of intimacy, perhaps bureaucratization of intimacy, but you know, if you go back to the 19th century, it's really important just to remember, and also that could be a way of framing other debates. There was an obsession coming from an institutional obsession, absolutely, with pinpointing and policing sexuality. And, you know, prime example, homosexuality becoming a sort of punishable identity, whereas before sodomy was the crime. And so the analog, people I work with had to go to a trans awareness workshop, and the first thing that the person who led the workshop led with was, you know, a description of their genitalia and what they hope to do with it and what they see the future of that genitalia doing and how it fits with their idea of gender. And that is sort of shocking in a way, that workplace and universities with consent classes are now about, first thing you need to know, mandatory training, what people's genitals are all about. But that's a sort of long mirror image, I think, of what was already really starting to get into gear in the late 19th century. So I suppose I would urge you not to dismiss the sexual stuff I'm talking about as just kind of funny or not funny or whatever, or kind of grim to do with young people, but actually to think of it as a nice microcosm of other dynamics to do with identity, to do with new ideas about rules and borders that have actually been entrained in various ways, perhaps first and foremost when it comes to governing the body for a really long time.
Thanks. Sabina.
Well, yes, I do think that the debate of open borders has come along with a very sort of trend to sterilize the discussion. So, you know, the points which were made that there is a massive hypocrisy behind this whole thing, I think is very true. So you've got this discussion about open national borders, and at the same time you have a debate about, you know, not talking, no platforming was one example, but even not talking to democratically elected parties. So you've got, you know, the populists, you have to draw a clear distinction against populists. That's what establishment parties are saying. You know, not even debating them on television. We've had all of that, you know, normal politicians from the established party saying we won't do a public debate with anybody who represents, for example, the German AfD, which is, you know, creating clear limits and in a very undemocratic way. I'm not quite sure what you mean with a level playing field, but maybe what you mean is that obviously we have a world which is very, very unequal, and the discussion which we've often had in the past, that people come, that there is a certain pull factor of countries which have, you know, a much higher living standard, and something we have to face up to and something we have to deal with. And I think that's also... I think that's very true, and that's part of opening up the debate. So I know a few people who are, quite a few of my friends are actually open border freaks, and they tell me the way to solve poverty in the world is by opening the border. It's very easy, you know, let everybody come, and we're going to have an evening out of, I don't know if evening out, but a leveling of living standards. And I don't believe that anymore. I think that's quite wrong. And I think it actually takes us away from maybe more, you know, different, thinking more broadly, thinking a bit, being a bit more flexible in our discussion of how to solve the problems of this world, you know, going back to asking the hard questions. Why is it that some countries are so poor? What exactly is, for example, the EU doing, you know, with all its huge pontifications and rhetorics of helping Africa? You know, Angela Merkel is actually the worst in all of 2 years ago. She called for a Marshall Plan for Africa. We've never heard anything of it anymore anyway. But so all of that, I think, we have to draw out and just, you know, open up the debate. That would be my solution.
Okay, great. I want to see some more hands because we definitely want to come out. Okay, I don't know where the microphone is, but let's take this lady here. And then if we take this lady also at the front, and then we'll come back so I see that person as well.
Yeah, one thing I've struggled with for a while now is trying to work out why, just as boundaries between different sexes are being called into question, boundaries between different racial groups are being constructed, which seems illogical when you think there's much more of a biological basis for differences between the sexes, and biological differences between races are arguably far more fluid, and yet that's where people are trying to construct far more rigid boundaries. I mean, so much so that, as we saw with the case of Rachel Dolezal in the US, even often raising questions around the idea that race might be, that it's possible to be transracial, is enough to have you thrown out of polite society and ironically kind of constructing another boundary, another border then between those who are in the know about the correct thinking in relation to race and gender and those who are not. The only way I can begin to understand this is in relation to political interests and power, that it's become politically useful perhaps to reinvent borders in kind of new ways. So even in relation to transgender, we're now told that transgender is based in people's brains. So there is a biological basis. It's not between men and women anymore, but it's between cis people and trans people. And this is a biological brain-based difference. So kind of resuscitating a border, a new border, just one that we can't see.
Great, thanks. So there's this lady here. That microphone can go up to, there was a gentleman, I don't know where he's gone now, but maybe he can put his hand up again and we'll find him. If not, there's plenty of people over here. Say, for example, put this lady first.
People are embarrassed, especially in my sphere, which is immigration law. People are embarrassed about talking about the national border and the nation state and are embarrassed about it, and I think we can't think of that as a good thing. The effect of that, I mean, I was just thinking of what Rebecca said about we have special obligations to our children, but we're kind of not allowed to think like that anymore. And I think the problem about no borders is that we're effectively being made to think that we can't think that we have special obligations to people who live in our own country. And what that then turns into is migrants who are attempting to migrate, say, from Africa to Europe. It's almost, I want to use the phrase, the tyranny of the weak. The way that they're talked about by NGOs who are talking about migration problems, it's almost as if the question, are they allowed to come here, or should they have allowed to come here, or should we welcome them, or whatever, doesn't get asked anymore. It's almost that they are a feature of the world. For example, people in the Calais jungle and so on. It's how they ought to be allowed to come here. And it's almost that they've put themselves in a position where there's no international law, no prior agreement about how they should be treated, and yet they're kind of it's almost like an unspoken demand. You have to pay attention to me, like a child says. You have to pay attention to me. And as the adult, we're not allowed to say, no, you're not entitled to that. This may sound a very sharp point that I'm making, but that's almost how it's experienced. When the first waves of non-Commonwealth migrants came to the UK, in the 80s, the first response, if you like, of the right wing was to say, well, they can't all come here, so we've got to do restrictive things. And because of the law on asylum, the only way they could do that was stigmatising them as bogus. And there were very few people who said, these are economic migrants. From their point of view, they're entitled to try and seek a better life for themselves. The question is, what attitude should we take to that? And so I think somebody over there said there's a very dishonest debate about this, and that's really what I'm saying about the no borders position.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so there's that gentleman that's got the mic. Anyone desperate to get in? Okay, so there's a lady there on the end. We will come back out again, but I'll get the panel in after that lady. But this gentleman first.
I think it got touched on a couple of times about the debate about borders seems like quite a Western debate that we're having here, whereas one of the biggest borders in my lifetime, well, not mine, but my parents', was the line between India and Pakistan. And I think that was proof of what borders can do in terms of violence, in terms of death, in terms of all sorts of bad things that borders bring. And then I was interested in Sabina's point or view on opening borders, but actually opening borders at convenience to a certain country. So Britain opens borders when it wants certain people. Germany opened borders to Turkey when it needed certain people. And then Frank's view on what that then means for culture, because the people who then come or go into another place and have gone or jumped over the border, what happens to them? Because I'm noticing now that as a second-generation British Indian person, the culture that is living and breathing in the UK is very different to what my parents came to and what the future will look like. And that manifests itself through yoga in all things, because you see yoga as a very Western concept now in the way it's marketed and the way it's seen. But what does that mean in terms of how culture's going to move on if we open borders, close them, but then you've got people on both sides not knowing where they fit?
Okay, so there's that lady there.
I would like to think about how we arrive at having a capacity to either want open borders or want to shut them. I talk to my European friends, and my Dutch friend says to me, oh, I grew up being able to access at least 3 television stations from different countries, and that's why I speak the languages, and I watch all my cartoons and everything in 3 languages. So she starts off by seeing difference as extending the range of her own personality rather than something threatening. So it's enjoyable. And the reason why she speaks English is because she was able to hear and like English pop songs. So she just kept singing them and therefore knew how to do it. But in Britain, the experience is very different. And that's why we call ourselves an insular nation. And we're also very dominant in our history, so that we expect everyone to speak English. So when we go to Europe, all the conferences are held in English, so that we never get the full force of culture of people speaking to us in their language and us struggling to speak to theirs. So I think all these sort of structural things in the way nations live actually either predispose us to wanting boundaries and shutting ourselves in, or enjoying opening up and seeing the benefit of it. And I would like the panel to sort of comment on this.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I want the panel to reflect definitely on those last couple of questions, and especially there's a sort of question I'm asking about the, I mean, people can experience the hardness of borders as something like very threatening and very bad. And if you think about binaries that cropped up in recent years, the binary between an economic migrant and an asylum seeker that excludes huge varieties of people. And so there's a lot of, I think, a lot right to reflect on about the fact that borders have an exclusionary function. And so whatever criticism we might make of borderlessness has to take into account the negative effects felt by those who experience the sharp end of borders. I'll start with you.
Just very, very quickly, actually, on that point, Jacob, it really, really frustrates me when policymakers conflate migration and migrants and refugees, not least because refugees are often people who don't want to migrate. They feel that they need to migrate, and that they want to return home when their country returns to some semblance of normality or safety. But I wanted to respond really to your question from over there. Nice point about now being a moment to reassess, because I certainly personally felt that one of the great opportunities of the Brexit vote was a moment for, and a needed moment for, institutional re-examination, both to find out, as I think you mentioned, what it is we value, and as this is an opportunity I think that's been sadly missed, this point, this opportunity for examination, but so not just to find out what we value as a nation, but also to ensure legitimacy. So my view is that political control is legitimised by democracy in the sense of self-rule, in the sense of having political purchase, in the sense of being a full member of society. I mean, I wear this on, not on my sleeve, but literally on my front. I'm wearing a T-shirt with John Locke on it. So I guess what I'm saying is that I'm a massive liberal, but I also see it's hard. I think it's hard to understand how this sense of political purchase and some kind of contract really works well on a scale outside of the nation state, not just in terms of size, but also in terms of being tied together by social and cultural norms. And I think that the ratio of, you know, sort of 70,000 to one, and then when you're voting for MP, or on a smaller scale, when you're voting for a local representative, seems to me to retain some sense of genuine purchase. Whereas when we think about laws being made by 500 people, you know, representing for 500 million people in the EU, where there is no sense of purchase, then I think it sort of gets to the heart of the matter.
Yeah, sure. Zoe, one thing you'd like to pick up from there?
I was going to agree with the race-sex contradiction, but I think I'm going to pick up on the sharp end of borders issue. And my question there is, yes, I mean, I'm glad that there's more liberalisation, there's less pain, terribleness in the sexual domain. Also, we have a more humane approach to the other in a national context. My question is, you know, we might want to think, is there a way to have it all? I think the rhetoric and the discourse is extremely polarizing. Is there a way to be openish in ways that is kind of sort of reasonable, can you have liberalization and meaning? Can you have control? Can you have it all? Is there a way to have it all?
Great, thanks. Sabina, can you pick up a quick thought from that?
About the harshness of borders, I find that's an interesting point, and I wouldn't underestimate that. So I've lived in Germany, which had a pretty harsh border. Several people died, maybe not as hard as the Pakistani or Pakistan-Indian border. But I think it's really important, because sometimes I think we're fetishizing borders. You know, we look at that border as something which has a life in itself, and it doesn't. So we have to always look at borders in a certain context. So the reason why the border between Germany was so hard, or the South and North Korean border, is because of the realities of Cold War and the realities of conflicts. I would say I've heard the argument in terms of Brexit too. So people saying, well, if you know we have a border again to Northern Ireland, it'll be we're going back to the former times. That's not true, because you know if the political situation changes, why should a border be so terrible? So I came to Britain yesterday, and I had to show my passport. I had to cross a border, and I didn't find it threatening in any way. So, I always think that we have to put borders into context and look at the conflicts behind them, and not fetishize the actual construction.
Great, thanks. One quick thought, Frank.
Yeah, well, I think that it's important not to confuse migrancy and the problems that they have with borders, because migrants and refugees don't come to Britain to live in a borderless society. Now, they want to live in a society that's got very strong borders as well. And when India and Pakistan had that difficulty, it wasn't the borders that caused the problems, but the policy of divide and rule and the violence that preceded it, which kind of created the real difficulty. So it's not the borders that ever create the problems, but the dynamic, the political dynamic exists within that. And I think our approach has got to be contextual. So as I'm a refugee. I fled Hungary to Austria. So I know what borders are like, and something I really live. But I think you could take different attitudes. So I used to have a very open-minded idea of opening as much borders as possible. Today I take a very opposite point of view, not because I want to keep migrants out, but because in every discussion, including this discussion, we never ever consider what is the situation of the border of the people that receive the migrants. You know, sort of what do we think about them? And do we ever think about the impact that the movement of people has on the societies into which people come in? That's never considered, because that's labeled immediately under racism. That's a racist idea. But in fact, you've got to consider both elements. You know, the people who ought to be sort of consulted about the flow of people into their communities as much as anything else. So I think that context element is really quite important. And
leave it there. Sorry. All right. I want to come back out, because I know there's some more hands. So there's certainly that. There's two people up there that we'll take. There's a person there as well. We might be able to come back down to the front as well if everybody is really succinct.
Frank suggested there was a connection between, on the one hand, the whole question about borders collapsing and all these borders going up in the bedroom, and maybe one way of thinking about the connection between the two things is that the borders, well, what comes to my mind is the idea that the borders between nations are kind of like a big brother state, and the borders in the bedroom are like big sister state. And as, the left used to think of the project of the nation as one of delivering democracy and better welfare and a better life. And as that belief in the nation has declined, the belief in a more sort of feminized sort of authority seems to have risen in the vacuum. And maybe that's the connection between the two things.
Okay, great. You're going to pass that behind you. There's a guy with a mic there. Everyone's going to be very quick and succinct.
Just a point about asylum laws and borders, because I think in the past, asylum was actually used to bolster borders. And when I say the past, I mean in the days of the Cold War, because it was used as a means of saying, oh, you refugees from the East have left communism and come to a better society here in the West. So it was a way of a nation state in the West saying, we have a better system and a better society. And the migrants who came, whether they were the Faraday family or not, all very much wanted to embrace that notion of leaving behind something they saw as undesirable and coming to something that they saw as better. So the asylum system then was very much used to bolster the nation state. You can see now how it is completely different, in the sense that if anyone said now all these people from Africa or Asia are coming to a better society in the West, you would be accused of being racist. And also, most of the migrants who are coming from these countries have no intention whatsoever of assimilating or absorbing the norms that we think are integral to Western liberal democracies. So that is why I think the asylum system now has turned completely from being a way of helping and supporting borders and become a way of completely undermining them.
Great, thanks. There's that gentleman there.
Yes, I'd like to support the concept of context. I would say that there's a difference between a border in itself and a friendly or unfriendly border. I think a border that you're not allowed in could seem very exclusive, and one that you're not allowed out could seem oppressive, and a border that allows you in seems very welcoming, and a border that you feel protected by can give you security. And I don't think that, as an example, with the recent whatever happens in the end of Brexit, I would say that the concept of being allowed to travel relatively freely to such a large number of countries is most extraordinary concept, although most people probably don't take advantage of it. But this isn't about not having borders, it's about having friendly borders. And I think to have friendly borders, you have to have a certain amount of security, and that a border in some way presupposes a society. And if you actually get rid of the actual border, then you start undermining systems of government and community. And I probably was going to say something else, but I can't remember.
Yeah, thanks. It's good. No, it's great to leave it there. We're going to hear from this lady, then the panel are just going to get 45 seconds or so to sum up.
My question is, basically, you see...
Can you stand?
There's these problems with borders and migrants, and I mean, I'm only 17, and you can just see this everywhere in the news, and there's clearly like an issue. Like, I have friends in Syria and Tajikistan who work so hard to try and travel, and they study much harder than me to try and get a better education for their future. But by closing these borders and making these laws, which I feel like it's depriving education. So how can we move towards an inclusive future if we're closing our borders off to other people?
Okay, great, thanks. So I'm going to let people sum up in the sort of reverse order. So that means we'll start with you, Sabina. Seriously, it's going to be literally 45 seconds because we've got a short turnaround next.
I think the asylum point is really important, because you can only offer asylum if you have borders, because the whole point is that you the other country, which it respects the border where the asylum seeker, the border the asylum seeker crossed. I think that if we want to solve the problems we have, I think we can only solve them if we have the support of the majority of the population in our countries. And I think that's what we should be working towards. And maybe then we can always also come towards solving some of the problems you raised, you know, creating a society which is more open and at the same time, you know, supportive of the ideas. But at the moment, I think we're doing the contrary.
Great, thanks. Zoe, just a quick thought to end.
Yeah, I think so much of these issues are to do with false fineries, to do with what's okay and what isn't okay. If we can defang the idea of borders, whether that's in the, you know, taxonomies in the bedroom or what's woke or what isn't, then we can sort of lower the barrier. We can start thinking properly, and we can start sort of not having to fight against things that are just going to occur naturally, like borders, and actually have impose a more intelligent shape on them.
Great, thanks. I'll head over to Rebecca.
Thanks. Yeah, it sort of strikes me, we've spent quite a lot of time thinking about borders to prevent people getting into places, and not so much about borders to prevent people getting out. And this is odd, not least because I think an example we've touched on several times, which is the Berlin Wall, was, of course, in the end, effectively, it was a border to stop people getting out, to try and find a better life elsewhere. Just struck me, really.
Great, thanks. Finally, Frank.
Yeah, I mean, if you study philosophy, you'll know that Heidegger and a lot of others understood borders as not just the end of something, but as the beginning of something. And I think borders have a creative transformative element that we haven't really discussed. And the guy that was talking about the anarchist and the communist in the 19th century, you know, sort of creating havoc and in a kind of creative kind of a way, I don't think that they're like that the present anti-border movement is anything like that. Whatever you say about anarchists and communists in the 19th century, they had a positive vision that they were trying to sort of get society signed up to, whereas people today who are anti-border are basically far more interested in leaving the burden of responsibility behind. And I think that's why it's such a corrosive thing, and that's the dynamic either in the bedroom in relation to sex or in relation to the national borders that we see. It's leaving behind the burden of responsibility for your society. And in that sense, they're nothing like the 19th century heroic, you know, sort of revolutionaries that, you know, even in their worst moments, you know, had some positive elements to them.
Okay, so I'll ask you to thank the panel in a minute, but I just need to point out, firstly, you can continue sort of this discussion, firstly, by going to the session after this on patriotism in the Pitt Theatre just next door, but also elsewhere, but that seems maybe the most pertinent one. You can also continue the conversation, obviously, online on the hashtag Battle of Ideas Fest, but also broadly, you can continue the conversation by staying in touch. We'd love to find ways to keep in touch with you. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, or you can go to battleofideas.org.uk/subscribe, put in your email address, and we'll make sure that you stay up to date with everything else that's happening. This is the last keynote for the day, so you can go somewhere else, but do remember that at 6:45 in the conservatory there will be the drinks reception, so we can continue that conversation over a beer. But for now, can we thank the panel?